Brooklyn's Radio. Loving arts and entertainment.
Hi, this is Nick Kershaw and you're listening to Suzanne Hunter's World of Arts and Entertainment.
Now, I've often said, wouldn't it be good to talk to the talented singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist and record producer Nick Kershaw. So I'm really glad to welcome him onto the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you today.
Hi, Suzanne.
Now, you know, I couldn't resist that cheesy intro, but of course so many of your fans will know you're synonymous with the song Wouldn't It Be Good, that brilliant first single released in 1983, but of course also The Riddle, I Won't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, numerous hits, and of course they're no doubt going to be performed in your current tour, 80s Icons. Of course, it suggests from the title, going to focus on the 80s, and of course many of your hits were especially big at that time. What do you think it was about that era that made it such a sort of fertile breeding ground for diverse talent?
I get asked that question a lot, and I have to admit I haven't come up with a really satisfactory explanation. But it's—I don't know. I think a lot of things were happening. A lot of things were on the sort of music technology was kind of coming on in leaps and bounds, and there were lots of different kinds of genres kind of exploiting that and experimenting with it. So you got—I think the result was that you got a decade that was. Kind of non-genre specific, really, because there was so many people coming at it from so many different angles. There was jazz, there was rock, there was pop, there was kind of basically something for everybody in there, I think. And maybe that's one of the reasons that it's kind of lasted so long.
Yeah, I mean, what was it in particular do you think that inspired you to start creating the songs in the first place?
I wrote stories and a bit of poetry and stuff like that, and then I got into music and it's just something I kind of wanted to do. I mean, I didn't do it for a long time. When I was, but I played in a kind of functions band. I did very little of it then. Mm-hmm. I did that for about 3 years. But then, kind of, I don't know. I guess a sort of early '82 or so. I just kind of got my juices flowing, and I just started writing in earnest. And it was, yeah, it wasn't really something I really thought about. It's just something that is kind of a need rather than. And it's now, to a lesser extent, I guess, but basically, if you've got a song idea, you have to write the song. Otherwise, you just wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning with a really annoying tune in your head. So you just have to exorcise it by actually writing it and making a demo or just getting it out of your system. Really.
Yeah, if it keeps repeating the tune or something, or the words, you know, you've got to explore it really.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, there's something so reassuring about the 80s, the sort of music, the quality of the voices, and the revival's still going strong. I mean, the festivals like the ever-popular Rewind and the Let's Rock, you know, the 80s, they're full in full swing. Of course, it brings back a lot of memories, and, I mean, I've played over the 7-inch of Wide Boy many times, and, of course, it associates a lot of memories for people. Do you get that sense?
Yeah.
Do you get that sense when you're on stage?
My formative years were the 70s. So the same thing happens to me when I listen to, Bowie of that time and T-Rex and Deep Purple and all the stuff I was listening to in the 70s. I listen to it and I am transported back to being a 14-year-old boy. You know? So I can completely understand why that music does that for people.
Yeah, do you get that sort of sense? Do you get, you know, sort of when everybody's chanting back at you, you know, kind of you've definitely been in those formative years of their lives.
Absolutely. And you don't forget that. You kind of, it's like long-term memory. It doesn't matter. You can't find your car keys, but you can still remember the words to Gene Genie or something.
Yeah, it's amazing. Because you mentioned Black Sabbath there and Deep Purple, and I saw you got your funk on there. You get you rocking out there in the early years. Did you ever think about sort of moving into rock in that sort of sense?
I didn't really know what I was moving into, really. I mean, it ended up as kind of pop, but I'd been playing in jazz fusion bands and stuff beforehand, and I just kind of ended up writing what I wrote, really. I didn't know what genre it was. At various phases I'd been through before that. I was a skinhead at one point, so I had to listen to reggae a lot, and and
bit of Scar.
Yeah, a bit of Scar, bit of everything, really. I mean, I didn't sort of wake up one morning and think I've got to be a pop star or a rock star or a jazz star or whatever.
Yeah, kind of just a blend, just a fusion.
A natural progression. Yeah.
I mean, the band had a good name, didn't it? Fusion, because it is that kind of thing. Sometimes one thing goes on to another, doesn't it?
But I didn't name the band; they were already called Fusion when I joined them.
Wonder how many of those there are.
Yeah, quite a few.
I mean, I Won't Let the Sun Go Down on Me was like a major hit in Scandinavia, Switzerland, and the Netherlands. I mean, do you know why that might have been? Any thoughts on that one?
No, they were the first to the party, actually. Yeah, they kind of, it was released the first time in '83, and it was kind of, although I didn't know this at the time, to be honest, I found this out later, that it was a major hit in those countries, but it wasn't a hit over here until it was re-released.
But
Scandinavia's always been a good sort of territory for me.
Yeah, they like to party.
Yes,
which is
they
good.
Do.
I mean, tell us about the inspiration behind Wouldn't It Be Good, The Riddle, that sort of thing.
Well, Wouldn't It Be Good was the last song I wrote for the first album, for the Human Racing album, and it was kind of written, we'd already started recording the record, if I remember rightly. And I don't think that, so there is no demo of that song. It was never properly demoed. It was just kind of in my head until we got into the studio, and I could just had to sort of sing it to the producer and say, and then this happens, and then that happens, and we just kind of made it up as we went along. But the song itself, I mean, lyrically, it's just about envy, really, and, you know, not counting your own blessings. That's about
yeah
the riddle. I guess that was written in a big hurry because I had about 2 weeks to write all the songs for the second album.
Oh really?
Yeah. That was madness. Tuned very quickly, but the lyric was just kind of, the original lyric was just a bit of nonsense I wrote. So it just rhymed and it just kind of showed off the tune. And we started recording the song, and I put the nonsense down as a guide so we could sort of record around it. And I tried to rewrite the nonsense, but it never got rewritten. And for anything I tried, it just sounded wrong. It just didn't. We got so used to the sound of the words and the rhythm of the words that we kept it as it was.
Yeah, and the video's great as well, isn't it, of course?
Yeah, that was one of my better ones, I think. Yeah. Not that I had a lot to do with them.
No, really, yeah, because they were quite big in the 80s, weren't they, videos and everything?
Yes, but certainly knew how to spend your
money, that's for sure. Yeah, definitely. Now, of course, Chas Hodges from Chas and Dave said, if a song's good, it's good for all time, and I think that's true, really. As a songwriter, do you have sort of particular hooks or techniques which you've used to kind of immortalise a song?
I've never really done that. I just went through a period in my life when I just wrote songs that I liked, I like that, and I enjoy singing it, and blah blah blah, and it was a period where other people felt the same way, which is good.
Yeah, you kind of get into that zeitgeist of, you know.
You only start questioning it when you do something you think is great, and then not everybody else does. What went wrong there?
Yeah, he's standing on stage, no one's singing or anything.
But you know. Yeah, you can. I think you just have to be honest about it. I don't really have any specific techniques or anything that I know about.
Yeah, just right from the heart, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the sun seems to be a bit of a link between you and a certain Sir. You know, you won't let the sun go down on me, and he wrote, "Don't let the sun go down on me." So,
Elton,
who copied who?
I thought of it first. I just didn't actually record it.
Oh, brilliant! Now, he mentioned, he described you as one of the greatest songwriters of your generation. Obviously a discerning man. But I mean, what spawned the songwriting bug for you?
I guess, I don't know. I don't know what it was. It's just something about performing. I mean, I used to put on shows in my back garden and charge people tenpence.
Entrepreneur.
Before decimalisation. I don't know what the shows were. I used to just sort of run about and make a twat of myself. But then I got sort of fed up with it, you know, and I was kind of, I never really wanted to do other people's songs it just seemed natural to me to make my own things up. I made my own stories up. Complete things to do, really, just to sort of, if you wrote and performed something, it's more about you. I guess it's just all about attention seeking. You get down to it, basically.
Yeah, the inner child coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true, though. I mean, it's about improvising or coming up with something original, isn't it, rather than someone else's. But, of course, I mean, your father was a flautist, I believe, and your mother was an opera singer. Do you think this rubbed off on the genes somehow?
Oh, I can't go. You couldn't have done any harm, I guess. No. I mean, it was always around. But like any kid, you didn't want anything to do with what your parents did.
Yes.
So I didn't really take an interest in my own kind of musical journey until I was sort of early teens, really.
Yes.
Although I did torment them with violin lessons at one point.
Oh.
When I was about, I would have been sort of 11 or 12 then, even then, yeah.
Yeah, it's always painful when you're first starting that, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
For people listening.
Not a good instrument to learn.
Now, of course, we talked about Fusion, the early band and what have you, but of course it was a reply from Melody Maker. That was a bit of a life changer. Tell us about that.
Well, the band I was in that split up because we just ran out of work. So I was on the dole for about a year, and I started writing in earnest then, and then I kind of made demos, my sort of homemade demos, and sent them off and hiked them around all the major record companies in London, got a nice sort of nice accumulating pile of rejection slips. And I thought, what am I going to do now? My last kind of roll of the dice, really, was just stick an advert in the back of the Melody Maker looking for management. And I got a response from various weird responses from, like, investment companies and a few dodgy ones. And
there was
one from this bloke going by the name of Mickey Modern.
Ooh.
I thought, he must be very modern. Like that. But he was the manager of Nine Below Zero at the time. And I thought, well, I've heard of them. I know them.
Yeah.
He got in touch, and I sent him the tape and met him, and we kind of got together, and he took my, you know, the same demos to the same record companies and got me a deal.
Ah, all started from there. Fabulous. I mean, since then you've been responsible for many hits over the years, including The Woman I Love, which was a hit for the Hollies. Elton John, the song An Old Friend. Did you write that one?
I did.
And you played guitar on Nikita.
Yes,
an Act of War, and it was on the Duets album, obviously. And talking of duets, you were with Kim Wilde as well. So Love Conquers All, going to play that
tune. Oh yeah, I forgot that.
Yeah, it's lovely. And of course, former guest Steve Hackett from Genesis as well. You sung vocals on the
Mamiya. That was. I was a big Genesis fan when I was a kid, so that was lovely to do. I also worked with Tony Banks earlier, in the 90s.
Oh, fab. I mean, would you prefer to work solo, or do you enjoy collaboration?
As far as writing and stuff goes, I've got a bit selfish, really. I spent a lot of time in the 90s working with people and writing with new acts and stuff like that. I think the older you get, the more selfish you get. I found myself holding all the best ideas for myself, and that's not the right way of working with people, really. And also, I'm a bit of a control freak, so I like doing things myself.
Yeah, well, why not, you know? I mean, as I say, you've written for many diverse performers, and they range from Ronan Keating, Cliff Richard, to Gary Barlow, to Archbishop Desmond Tutu. I've got to ask about him.
One of those is obviously a bit tongue-in-cheek.
A bit of a Josh, isn't it?
A bit of a Josh, yeah, just to make sure you're paying attention.
I was hoping.
Just when it is.
I wanted to see him rapping at one point, but there you go. I mean, how did fellow songwriter Gary Barlow feel about the second songwriter? How was he on that one?
Oh no! I got contacted by Gary when he was in between Take That, if you remember that period in his life, and he bought his first solo album, which really didn't do very well. So he was a bit down in the dumps, a bit low of self esteem. So he thought, I know what I'll do. I'll give Nick Kershaw a call. So we got together and we wrote. Probably one of the worst songs I've ever written, to be honest, and I'm sure it's not high on his list. I think it was demoed at some point. I don't even have a copy of it anymore.
Oh, right, in the archive
but
somewhere.
But he did what he should have done in the first place, which is obviously go back to say that, and then carried on writing great songs.
He was a boost, obviously, working with you, and then it got him on the right road.
It was the thing that just got him going. Again.
Exactly.
Responsible for the rest of his career.
Absolutely. Well, take that credit. Brilliant. And, of course, talking of that, many songwriters and producers, they're kind of the unsung quiet heroes. You only have to look at the modest Rod Temperton. You know, it just proves that, you know, once again, you proved you were the one and only songwriter there with that number one hit with Chesney Hawkes. Did you want to write that song, talking of doing things control-wise, did you want to sing that song for yourself, or were you happy for Chesney?
No, it never occurred to me. I mean, it kind of coincided, but I'd already made the decision to not re, you know, get, I got, when my deal ran out with MCA Records, I already made the decision not to go looking for another deal, and to take a back seat and start writing, and that was kind of the first one out of the bag, and I didn't really think that much of it, to be honest. I just stuck it on the shelf, and it was sitting on the shelf for about 2 years before Chesney's dad walked in to have that one.
Really? So that was it? Oh, brilliant. It's often the way, though, isn't it? Sometimes you don't put too much attention on it. Suddenly it goes,
and also, you know, at the time, had I released that song in some shape or form at the time, you know, the time was wrong. It would not have happened. It wouldn't have happened for me. And then, of course, Chesney turns up, fresh-faced, new talent, and media's all over him. And there's a new film, et cetera, et cetera, and it all kind of came together.
Yeah, Sky High. I mean, did it get written and then featured in the film? As it must have been
that
way around.
Really last minute. I think I think that there was a final edit of the film that they managed to squeeze the song kind of in the background going on headphones or something that someone was listening to in the studio, but it wasn't actually part of the soundtrack.
Like it's a buddy song, wasn't it, the film there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, is this a song for you that keeps on giving, would you say?
It's been very good to me, yeah.
Yes,
It gets used on adverts and stuff quite a lot.
Brilliant, lovely. I mean, I saw Chesney Hawkes in Panto as Prince Charming last year in Red Hill.
Okay.
And he was singing the song naturally, so I'm sure that must have pleased you.
I saw him there as well.
Did you?
We usually make a thing of New Year's getting together and, if he's in Panto somewhere.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's fantastic. And, of course, some directors have sought your music out for soundtracks over the years. Doc Hollywood, starring Michael J. Fox. Wouldn't It Be Good was covered, of course, by Danny Hutton Hitters.
Yeah.
For John Waters in the teen flick Pretty in Pink. How do you feel about having your music used in soundtracks?
In most circumstances, I'm happy to have it used, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's kind of... Because you don't envisage it as a soundtrack to anything. It's a song.
Yeah.
So to hear it,
within a different context,
within
isn't it?
A different context, it is, you know.
That's right.
Right, and you kind of see another way of seeing that song.
That's right. I mean, I loved Tony Hawk's book, Round Island with a Fridge, which is sort of inspired by one of those famous dares that he's always given himself. But you performed the soundtrack for when it became a film in 2010. And If It Gets Much Better? It sounds like a bit like Father Ted sitcom. That doesn't get much better than this Ted. How did that come about?
That was a weird one. That was kind of I'd known Tony for a bit, and then he decided, because he's a songwriter too, so he's got this little house in he still got it in the Pyrenees. About five or six of us went down there for just a few days to chill out and write a few songs. And that was before the film was even thought of, I think. I mean, obviously the book was written, but I don't think they were thinking of making the film. But when the film got made, he just kind of took some of the songs from that trip and used them. So it wasn't let's write some songs for this movie.
Just kind of came about organically, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. I mean, you've received accolades from such legends like Eric Clapton, Miles Davis, and you've been nominated for 4 Brit Awards. I mean, you know, that must have been amazing. Did you feel good about those accolades?
Yeah, it is astonishing, especially when it comes from somebody you really don't expect. I mean, it's lovely to, have Eric Clapton and Jimmy Page turning up to your gigs and stuff. That really is fantastic. But yeah, the surprising one for me was obviously Miles Davis. Extraordinary geezer, and I kind of, he tried to contact me at one time. I just didn't actually believe it was him. I thought someone was taking the mickey. So and it wasn't until he turned up at a gig in New York that I realized it was real, and it was actually him. In fact, when he died, his band was routine in one of my songs, I think.
That's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah,
real legend. I mean, what's next musically for you then, Nick?
I'm always, I do bits and pieces for TV, TV music and stuff, which is sort of ongoing. My last album is 2012, so I'm going to I need to get my finger out. I'm working on it and hoping it's going to be this year.
Yeah, well, we're pretty busy at the moment. And going back to the 80s, I mean, the concert that eclipsed all other venues, of course, was Wembley Stadium in 1985. Tell us how it felt to perform at Live Aid and how you found the whole experience.
Well, terrifying. It's the word that leads to mind, yeah.
Really?
But it was, I just got involved because Bob Geldof was just kind of lurking at Heathrow Airport one morning in January. 85, just kind of because there was a bunch of us off to some pop show in Germany or something, and he was just kind of press ganging people into supporting the the cause. I mean, so also we said, yeah, sure, thinking, well, it'll be a little gig, it'll be Hammersmith Apollo or something. Then it just got bigger. Then it was Wembley Arena. Then it was the stadium. Then it was going on in Philadelphia. Then it was 2 billion television audience. And then it just all got completely mental. But it was, yeah, terrifying, because there was no real preparation for it. You just kind of turned up and hoped that your gear worked.
Really. Oh, gosh, really?
It's not like anybody was watching.
Oh, no, just a few billion. He obviously had big plans, didn't he? He was keeping it all to himself, and then it exploded onto the world stage.
It did, yeah. It was really crazy.
It really was a who's who of music, massive lineup. But, of course, on the 80s Icon Tour, you've got a triple bill of 80s brilliance on one stage. Mm. And alongside yourself are going to be, the band who gave us The King of Wishful Thinking and I Died in Your Arms Tonight, of course, Cutting Crew and Go West. Is this the first time you've been on tour together?
No, I have to say it isn't. We've toured Australia together a few years ago, and I did a UK tour with Go West and Carol Decker about 2 years ago.
Oh.
I think, yeah.
Brilliant. Also, you know each other then. Will you do anything together, or is it going to be three
separate
sets?
Yeah, we are kind of, Cutting Crew are opening for us, but me and Go West are on stage, on and off stage together all through the evening, so we're kind of stage bumming each other and screwing up each other's songs. And then throwing a few little cheeky covers in just to confuse people.
Oh, really? Oh, it's going to be absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's a full tour, but it's going to be on the 4th of February at the popular New Victoria Theatre in Woking, and also in Wimbledon on the 11th of February. So are you ready to wow the Woking and Wimbledon audiences?
Yes, as ready as I ever will be. it starts on Thursday.
Oh, fabulous. What can they expect? Are you going to get any songs in from your recent albums, or are you just going to stick with 80s specials?
I think the clue's in the name.
I think so.
Really,
we didn't
name the tour. That was done by the promoter, but it is called 80s Icons.
It keeps the focus, doesn't it? Otherwise, it could be
it
everything.
Does.
Couldn't
I mean,
it?
I think we understand with there can't be many people buying a ticket thinking, oh, I hope they play something we don't know.
Yes.
So, we know what they want, and they know they're going to get it.
Yeah.
We're complicit in that particular.
Fantastic. I mean, I bet you're going to get everybody rocking on their feet. It's just it's going to be a fantastic night, I have no doubt. But it just remains me to say thank you very much for being on the show, Nick.
Thank you.
I wish you all the best for the tour and the new album when it comes out.
Thanks, Susan.
So thanks very much to my very talented guest, Nick Kershaw.
Brooklyn's Radio. Loving arts and entertainment.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with The Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.